Joan Seaman, Reel 2. Right, so could I ask you now about going into the WAFs, you know, and how you went about this?
Well, all my friends, particularly the fellows, we'd formed our own youth club because we were so fed up. You know, this is 1941 particularly. And we had a wonderful time. The Blitz was over and our parental authority was a bit relaxed and we did this entirely alone. But all the fellas, of course, they were all being called up. We did a play, French Without Tears. I was the director of it and it was a great success. And we all managed to do it before we all disappeared. Anyway, I thought I'm not going to wait, as I said before, to be called up. I just fancied the RAF because the uniform was rather good and most of my friends were... I preferred that to the khaki of the ATS. So I went to the recruiting place at Edgware, which was the nearest one, and I said I wanted to join, yes, and they took the particulars and everything like that. And they said, what do you want to be? So I said, in my ignorance, something to do with radar. And they said, the woman said, are you good at maths? And I said, no. Never really learnt maths at that little private school I went to. And she said, well, I think Clark SD would be good for you. And I said, what's that? And she said, Clark Special Duties, working for a lot of the time in the operations room. And I thought, oh, yes, that sounds good. So I said, fine. So she said, well, wait till you're called up. So I said, okay, and I went home, and we waited, and as I say, I just got past the first night, and a week later, I went, I think it was July the 19th, that seems to stick in my mind, in 1942, this was.
And you would have been how old then?
I was 19, and I went off to Bridgnorth, and my father cried. I didn't know that, but my mother told me afterwards, he just cried. Beloved daughter going up. My father and I were always very close, we're very much alike, we were. Anyway, I went up to Bridgnorth with a whole party of sort of girls I'd never seen or spoken to before, and they were all talking about going to a dance that night, and I thought, no, I don't think so, not for this. And of course we were met, and we were kitted out with all different things. Mine was a bit difficult because being tall, you know, you sort of went along a line and one bit of this, one bit of that. And
you were taken. Do you remember the bits you were given?
Yes. An awful vest, an awful bra, an awful long Air Force blue knickers with elastic, which nobody wore. I don't know a single person that wore them. You had to keep them, but you wore them. Two or three shirts with not the same collar. You all who has six collars, different collars, and a tie, and a skirt, and a jacket. Battle dress was only issued to people doing certain jobs. I was later on when I went abroad with the Bentley Players, but, you know, not at the time. And a hat and a kit bag. And your button cleaning materials, I remember, and your irons, knife, fork and spoon. They were always called your irons, and you had to hold on to your irons all the time. In fact, a friend of mine went to her fiancé's house for the first time, and when she finished dinner, she picked up a knife, fork and spoon and went out with it. Shows you how you were indoctrinated. And then we went into a hut. And there was your bed. And every morning, you did have sheets. The men didn't have sheets, but you had sheets and a pillowcase. And you had to fold your blankets and stack them in the exact way, three on top of each other, with one around the top and with the sheet sort of in the middle so they weren't seen. And that's how, because they had an inspection of your hut every day, and that's the way you had to do them. And then you had a kit inspection every so often, which everything had to be laid out in the right way. This is why I was quite happy to get out of the way. That was the thing I didn't like, things like that.
Did you you find you were meeting all sorts of different people?
Yes, very, very much. From the people who had a very sheltered lives and very rich people who couldn't, girls who couldn't understand, they couldn't have a private bath when they wanted to and that sort of thing. But then on the other hand, people who went to bed in their vests, you see, quite different. Me being rather in the middle, I was able to cope, you know, between the two. You know, there was something. Oh, yes. The first time I was asked to help in the, one of the warehouses or something like that. Of course, you mostly did square bashing and that sort of thing. And I was talking to a girl and she said, oh, she'd only just returned. She'd been away. And I said, oh, why have you been? Yes, she said, I had a baby, but I had it adopted. And it was the first time I had ever come across anybody who'd had a baby, an illegitimate baby. And it shook me to my foundation. I didn't let it show, fortunately. And I said, oh, yes. But, you know, that really, that was an eye-opener to me. You know, a girl from Penna. That wasn't that at all. But I stayed there. Well, we were supposed to stay for 6 weeks. We weren't allowed outside the camp. Everything was had to be on the camp. A lot of people were very homesick. Some of the sergeant and warrant officers, they were unnecessarily cruel and tough, which I could see that they didn't bother me particularly, but they made people scrub floors and things in a quite unnecessary way. And then we also had lots of intelligence tests. Well, I did, you know, for Clark SD. And I found a lot of people said they were going to be Clark SD. And when it came to outwork, there was only about 6 out of about 200 of us that were. We had colour blindness tests too, which I found out really afterwards. I also organised a show. We had to put on a show and I played the piano and I compared it. This was just after we'd had our jabs and I can remember, you know, with my arm out here somewhere, still doing it. I was asked to play the Warsaw Concerto ad nauseam and every time I said, no, you can't play the Warsaw Concerto without an orchestra. Oh, play us a bit of it then. Became quite good at doing bits.
Was there something about that was significant?
Oh, yes, it was just the sort of romantic music they liked. And Anton Warbrook was in the lead, and they're like, it's lovely, you know. Well, it wasn't a bad piece of music, but, you know, it was. And of course, it did make for popularity that I could sit on the piano and play for singing and being able to play by ear as well as by music. Oh, I'd forgotten too at that time. Not while I was at Bridgenorth, but before, and when I came back to London, to Stanmore, whenever I could, I played with a dance band called Ron Goodwin and his Woodchoppers. And Ron Goodwin later became a very respected film composer. He composed the music for Where Eagles Dare, for a start. But I was his pianist in everybody, they were all men, and just me. I had a lot of time with that, you know. But they were so protective; it was wonderful. We did this was later on when we did the American Red Cross clubs in Piccadilly and parts of it. But anyway, that's a little bit later on.
Yes, I must ask you about that because I think it would be very interesting.
Yes.
But at this time, you know, when you were saying about the tough sort of attitude of some of the NCOs and officers.
Yes, yes. Not the officers so much.
I beg your pardon,
yes,
NCOs.
More the NCOs.
Would they have been men or women?
No, women. Oh, it was the women that were nastiest. Oh, the men were not nasty. It was the women. At least I had my memory. I got one man later on, which I shall tell you about, was nasty. But no, it was the women that were, you know, power. They had power over these poor little frightened girls, and some of them were poor little frightened girls. But still, it built character, I suppose, you know, in one way. If you could take it, I mean, it was all right for me because I could take it. But anyway, after 6 weeks, everybody moved up except the Clark SDs. There was no place for them at the time, so we stayed and did our jobs around the camp. for about a week. And then the half a dozen of us were posted to Leighton Buzzard. And at Leighton Buzzard, they had a complete replica of the operations room at Stanmore in case London had been invaded, and the whole thing would have been moved to Leighton Buzzard, which was in the... So, of course, it was used as a training thing. And we were told about radar there and, you know, how secret it was. And we had to sign the Official Secrets Act, which scared the life out of me. I thought, oh, God, you know. But... And then, when it came to be posted, I was called into the office and I said that I was one of three people to be posted to Stanmore. Because they, sound very big-headed, they only picked the best to go to Stanmore because the grid that we plotted on was much smaller because we had the whole of the British Isles and a lot of France.
Do you think you could describe for me what a plotting system is?
Yes, this is... really one of the things I'd like to. And really how it differed from the sector and the group. This was the big thing. Well, the whole of the British Isles and part of France was divided up into large squares. And each large square had two letters, like WL, Willie London, as it was then. And in alphabetical order, but always two. I don't know whether the whole of the world was divided up like that. I'm not sure, but anyway, our particular thing was. That big square was divided into 10 smaller squares, that way and that, like a grid. The plots came through headphones. You were plugged into the table. The plots came through headphones from the radar filter room. And the plots were... oh, golly, if I can remember it. Stand By, I think, was the first, but I'm not sure. And then the plot came. Willie London 2-4. Willie London 2-4. Hostile 263, one at 200. And now this is where it differed. I must break off there. The sector group and where I was at Stanmore. In the sector, because you only had a small piece of... the grid was enormous, and you pushed the... a little... how should I say it? A little plaque around where a sergeant put the number of the raid and the height and the strength of the raid. And you pushed it along. You had arrows, big arrows in a sector, which you made a track as the plots came through your headphone. And that was sector. Group, because you had a bigger area, it was a bigger, a smaller grid, and a smaller Willie London thing. So sometimes you could push it. Sometimes you used a magnetic rod, which you pulled back, squeezed, put an arrow on the end and then plotted it there. At Stanmore, which is the only place in England like it, because you had the whole of the British Isles and France, part of France, you had a much, much smaller grid, which made it very much more difficult and much more precise. And you had an enormous long rod at some times to get to the place. It wasn't over it was around the sea. It was the coast. You didn't do the Royal Observatory Corps took over by a teleprinter over land. But this is the most important thing, obviously, was around the coast. So you had to have very nimble fingers and a clear speaking voice because you had to call what it was, and the ability not to panic, of course, because sometimes these plots came through your headphones at 12 or 14 a minute, and you did not have time to do anything. I mean, it was just, well, I'm sorry, I'm showing something which I can't. It was just pulling your arm back, picking one up and pushing it on, pulling your arm back as it came through. There was another complication that you had a clock in front of you. I think they've got one downstairs, actually, with red, yellow, blue, red, yellow, blue, every 5 minutes. And every five minutes, you had to plot in a different colour. But you had a sergeant who took off the old plots so that when you started plotting with blue, the sergeant would take off with her rod the arrow, and you got in the habit of squeezing a magnetic rod and flicking the arrows back so you caught them in your left hand. You really did. It wasn't surprising that the girls, there were three watches then, I'll come to that, but we were on three watches. Very few men. Girls were much better at it than men. In fact, the flight sergeant used to sometimes call out, take that man off and put a woman on. You know, that's something we did do. It wasn't surprising, too, at that time, well, at all time, I suppose, that the majority of girls there were either musicians, artists, actresses, and people like that. There were hardly any business people because you had to have the nimble fingers and the clear voice. And if you're an actress, a musician, or anything in the performing arts, you don't panic easily because you can't panic easily. There was quite a diverse array of people that we had there. We all got on quite well, though. Yes.
I wondered, you know, it sounds incredibly intense. How long you did this at a time?
Ah, well, when we were on three watches, it was dreadful because we came on watch at 8 o'clock one day, 8 o'clock to 1. We had the afternoon off, and then we went back again from 7 o'clock till midnight. And the next day, we didn't go on till 1 till 7. But then the next day, it was double watch again. We did that for 2 weeks, and then we did midnight till 8 o'clock for seven nights, that was it. We came off at 8 o'clock and went on at 7 o'clock that evening, and, you know, the cycle started again. We were supposed, and I do say supposed, to have one watch off every week in rota. Well, I mean, that was just a funny joke. No 48 hours or anything like that. You had 1 7-day leave. I can't remember quite when, but it worked out about 1 a year, I think, or something like that. And so people, you know, did get ill. It's amazing how people did not get ill. We had a rest. We were 50 feet underground, too. Yes, there was a complete block. We called it the underground. You had a special pass which you had to show every time you went underground. They did have a canteen above ground, but you never had any time for sleep or anything like that. We called it chained to the table. You weren't chained to the table the whole time, of course. Usually it was 2 hours on and 1 hour off. If the fog came down, you know, things were sort of relaxed a little bit. But in the hour, you didn't have time to have a nap. Some people did, but I never could. But you could get a cup of tea and that sort of thing. A lot of people played cards and knitted. But then, when the Americans came in, some of the girls released other WAF for other duties, not in the operations room. We did have somebody telling to an American headquarters sometimes, a couple of WACs. But more WAF were released, so we were put on four watches, which was the beginning of 1944, which was such a relief because of D-Day coming up. Oh, and yes, they enlarged the plotting room table all around what we knew as 10 group, around the Isle of Wight and that sort of thing, and that particular part of France, Normandy, about, a good 3 or 4 months before D-Day. And we all looked at it and said, we know where the invasion's going to be. And we must have all kept the secret, because Hitler, right to the last minute, thought that it was going to be invaded in part of Calais. But when the Americans came over, really, we were on then four watches, which made life a lot easier, because we were on from 7 till midnight, one day. The next day, we were on from 1 till 7. The next day, we were on from 8 till 1. But then we were off then till 7 o'clock the next night. And we thought we were in heaven. Oh, and while we were on three watches, Mrs. Roosevelt came. We had all the crowned heads of Europe, literally, you know, the lot, came down, and Mrs. Roosevelt came down, And I wasn't plotting on a very important play, so I could sort of hear. And Shorto Douglas was the head of Fighter Command then, of which I dare not say what I think or thought of him or think of him. Or do you want me to say?
Yes, I think so. This would be very interesting.
He was a pig. That's the only way I can describe him. He was a big fat pig, no consideration, and his manner was obnoxious, absolutely awful. He might have been wonderful in planning, but I'm just talking about what it was like as a member of the ops room staff. And he brought Mrs. Roosevelt down, and he said to the sergeant, Mrs. Roosevelt said to our sergeant, these girls working down here in these conditions, do they get much time off? And before Peggy had a chance to even say something, he said, they get 48 hours off every 10 days. Of course, she couldn't contradict him. Absolute lie. Couldn't get a thing. So, that was the... something I must say. When you started plotting there, you were put up in the north of Scotland because it was training, you see. That was 14 group, and then 13 group was sort of lower, southern Scotland. 9 group was what we called a stoogey area, which was Wales and the Irish Sea and that. And then 12 group was Norfolk and Suffolk, and you had to be careful then. 10 group was Cornwall and Devon and that. But of course 11 group, that was the big important post. And I felt very, very flattered. On the afternoon of D-Day, I went on 11 group. I was told to be put on 11 group. And the king came, and I didn't see him because he listened to me plotting and watched me plotting. But I didn't see him. Do you want to know? No. First of all, I think before D-Day, I'll tell you some of the other jobs that we did. There were liaisons all the way around on the balcony. Army, Navy, and there was a very special one which was just called BBC, which we realise now was really the line to Bletchley Park. That was what we knew. There was something very, very secret going on there, and Radlett, it was called, and we had to give details later on of all the flying bombs that were there and that sort of thing. We didn't receive information from them, but I remember sitting at that desk and giving information there. We also had tracers, which is something I never did, and there were 3 girls that sat at great big easels with maps, and they traced every raid that was on there. And as soon as they finished one sheet, they had another one. There was something called messenger, which everything was done by lamps and tube. And you had the messages of the lamps and tube. And of course, there were loads of other different... it was a complex underground, with different rooms and offices and that. And as the messages came down, you had to sort of take them around. I'm trying to go around. When I first went there, the air raid warnings were given from there. But that was only, I can't remember when it finished, but it wasn't very long. The air raid warnings were given from there. That was discontinued. We had a very senior officer, group captain, I think, and above, who was in charge there. Next to him was our watch flight sergeant, who was a very powerful man, and our watch sergeant, Bill Bailey, was absolutely wonderful. He was a love, he was a honey. It was his watch, and he protected you, which I came to know when I was in a sticky situation. He was absolutely wonderful. And then around, they were all the different liaison officers, all quite high-ranking officers all the way around. Just before D-Day, they instituted something above the plot, the other end of the, if you could say, the north end of the table, something we called a tote, which was like a Venetian blind, and on that you put the number and the height of strength of the raids, as or not raids. I don't mean hostile raids particularly, but everything that was plotted there. We had headphones on, and we did that, and it was, we were in a tiny little aperture behind, almost like a cupboard with three of us working there. I think it was probably 6 feet long by about 2 feet wide. And we had these headphones on, and we had to do it backwards, you see, to slot it through so that they could see. Which leads me to my one and only almost disaster in the Air Force. It's quite amusing, really. We had a warrant officer in charge of the administration of the block. Warrant Officer Wheeler, a large man. And he said, I'll leave a box there at the back, it was only room anywhere, to put, because as you get rid of the raid, you can just throw them into the boxes. Well, that made more work, I thought, so I'd organised my particular watch. As we took them off the front, there was some more slats at each side. We put them back at each side straight away in the right order. And we found that was easier. Well, we were right in the middle of a terrific flap. And this warrant officer Wheeler came round and looked at what we were doing. And there was a couple of these little hook things that had fallen on the floor. And he said, I gave you this box to put them in. You know, why haven't you put them in there? And I was so uptight. I said, if you can do it better, come and do it yourself. And, of course, he went off. I saw him through the slats going round and talking to the flight sergeant. And I thought, oh, God, I'm in for a charge. I'm in for everything. I thought I'd better take the... Well, when I was relieved, I went straight round to the flight sergeant and I said, I'm sorry, Bill. I said, I know I've been very, very rude to Warrant Officer Wheeler, but I think you know how hard we've worked round them and we've justified. And he said, don't worry, he said. I've told Group Captain so-and-so, who roared with laughter, and you won't have anything more said about it. which was great. The people who actually worked in the operations room, they were all on our side. In fact, another little episode which shows you how it all worked. The rest of the WAF and the WAF administration on the camp hated us because they saw and they thought that we were pampered. In fact, our nickname was Cochrane Young Ladies, and the rumour had it we were chosen for our looks as well as our skill. I don't think that's true, but on the other hand, we were in very much an advertisement, you know, for Britain's efficiency and that, and I don't think they'd have had somebody who was really repellent, you know. I think we had to look respectable. But anyway, the edict came out that we were all to do fire watching, and even the ops room girls had to take it in turns to be on the camp. So one girl said, oh, don't worry, I'll fix this. So she stuck it for 2 nights, and then in the ops room she pretended to faint. And of course, the high-ranking officers, what's the matter? You know, panic station. And then, of course, the edict came out. These girls are far too precious through do fire watching. This is ridiculous. So we didn't do any. Again, I'll tell you at this time, because it epitomises the sort of thing that, you know, you can get these power-hungry people. I had to go. I lost my gloves, which was quite fair enough. And you had to get a chip to get some more gloves. And I had to go to the warrant officer, Brimbookham, who was the WAP warrant officer, to her office to get this chip. So I left the haven of the operations room block and put my coat on, my buttons were polished, pulled my hair right off my collar, which was the right thing, walked over to the administration and found everybody with their gas masks on.